You're listening to episode 9 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi, welcome to the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, and this is a podcast about Linux and GNU and Unix and other things like that. Today it's going to be a lot about, I think, free art and art in general and sort of modern technology and art and other things that I like to think about. But it's also going to be about a Flex backup, which I think you will like. Some free Python books, and probably more stuff that I'm not thinking of, so let's get started. That sounds like a pretty good place to start. Okay, so, yeah, what to talk about first? Technology or art? Or the marriage of the two? How about if I give you a little bit of a teaser with some free books about technology? Because books are kind of art. Some books are. These are technical manuals, so it's really pretty straight up technology, but I still think this is worth mentioning. There's a list out there that I stumbled across. I don't really remember how I found it. The site is called linuxlinks.com. That's not a lot of linuxlinks.com. It's not the linuxlink.net. It is simply linuxlinks.com, and there's a list of 20 of the best, quote-unquote, best Python books. Of course, I hate lists that talk about the best of things, but this one is actually really handy. And spoiler, that's going to turn into a self-deprecating joke in a future segment, so just remember that. You'll understand it in a little bit. But for now, concentrate on Python, the best 20 best of the free Python books out there. This is not a shabby list at all. It has a lot of really good books, some of which I've actually read parts of. I cannot claim to have read all of any of them yet, but I have started on a couple. With lists like these, it's kind of easier to go and download all of the things that they're talking about than to try to remember that this list exists and go hunt it down in the future. So here's what I've got so far. Well, I mean, a couple that stood out to me and that I've either started reading or have at least browsed, or have read in the past and simply have downloaded now for posterity. One is Think Python. That's an O'Reilly book by Alan B. Downey. I have not read this, but I've started. I've actually started a couple of times. It is not a book so much to sit down and kind of take you through the language. At least, it wasn't that to me. Maybe that's how he wanted it to be. It wasn't really that for me. It was more... It's a really great, in my mind, a good reference manual. So Think Python is, it's a really good read. I think what he probably wants you to do, I would imagine, and I haven't talked to the author, so I don't know, but I imagine that he wants you to sit down, read it all the way through, and then kind of keep it around as a reference book. And I think that's probably ultimately how it's going to work for me. There's another one called Invent Your Own Computer Games with Python, and then another by the same author called, I think, Gaming in Python or something like that. The guy's named Albert Schweigert, and he's got a website called inventwithpython.com. The books are really fantastic. I've started reading both of them, kind of been going back and forth on them for a while. I keep meaning to sit down and really, really, really concentrate. I have not done that yet, but those I can highly recommend those. There's also this is supposed to be a really good book. And again, I've not even started this, but a lot of people have mentioned it to me, and it's called Learn Python the Hard Way. And at this point, I'm up for any non-traditional approach to teaching programming. I think programming is a really complex subject. A lot of people lately are trying to get into it, I think, and it's just something that there's so many different ways to approach it, and there's, I'm sure, not a right or a wrong way to approach it, and even per individual, you know, it just depends on what kind of situation you're in your life. Can you sit down and dedicate a bunch of time to doing this, or do you have to kind of poke around at it for a while until you find the project that's right for you, and so on and so on. So learning Python the hard way takes a different approach to teaching programming, and I think that sounds like a great idea. I think the more variety we have in the way that we teach programming, certainly the better opportunity for people to learn it well. Speaking of Python, learning more about Python, I started doing a bunch of hydrogen drum kits quite some time ago now, a couple of months ago, and I recruited some help so I didn't have to do it all, and the process was largely manual up front. We went through and found a collection of drum sounds, and then we put the drum sounds into some logical order, and the best logical order I could figure on was something called the general MIDI spec, let's call it. I don't know if people actually call it a spec, but it's general MIDI, and you can find that information on Wikipedia, wikipedia.org/wiki/general_MIDI, general_MIDI, I should say. And this is a list of all the MIDI sounds at each MIDI channel, the default sounds assigned to each MIDI channel. So at position 0, on channel 0, you've got acoustic grand piano, 1, bright acoustic, 2, electric grand, 3, honky-tonk, 4, electric piano, 1, 5, electric piano, 2, and then harpsichord and clavinet. And then you've got your chromatic percussion section, so channel 8, celeste, 9, glockenspiel, 10, music box, and so on. And it keeps going on and on like that until about 127, because it started at 0. And those are kind of, I don't remember or know who decided upon that, but it was something that they kind of figured out after MIDI had been around for a while. They thought, well, maybe we should assign this set of default sounds per channel so that if someone writes something with MIDI, they can send that MIDI file to other people, because obviously a MIDI file is splendidly small, right? So you send this little text file, essentially, of pulses that should happen at certain times and on certain channels that will trigger certain things, certain channels. And if we standardize what is assigned to each channel, then even if the composer is using, let's say, a Yamaha and then sends it to someone with a Roland, it will still sound pretty much the same. They might be different patches, but the violin is still going to sound like a violin. So very, very brilliant idea. And the point of all this was that I tried to align the drum sounds with the general MIDI definitions of what is going to be at a specific position within the drum portion of the general MIDI spec. That was all manual, so then I decided, well, what I really ought to do is make everything else automated, because I don't want to sit here and have to parse all of these sounds into this XML index file that Hydrogen wants to see when it opens up a drum kit. So that seemed like a very obvious thing to script, and indeed it was. And of course my fallback language is Bash, and I thought, this once I'm going to not use Bash, I'm going to force myself to use Python. And it was a great decision, it was a fantastic thing to do, and not only did I write a Python script that would automate, you know, any user who now has a set of sounds in a folder can use this Python script and end up with a Hydrogen drum kit. And that's very important, because a Hydrogen drum kit doesn't necessarily have to be a drum kit. It could be a collection of synth notes, you know, of sounds, and you could assign them to keys in Hydrogen and do all your sequencing in Hydrogen and never go out to any other program. So that's really, really cool. I thought that would be a handy thing to make available to everyone, just so that we could all make our own drum kits. Little did I know that my friend Doug Farrell, who has emailed me a couple of times before with kind of exonerations to, yes, get to know Python better. He's always giving me tips and pointers on Python. So he took the script, the Gen Hydro script that I created, and in some areas completely rewrote it, which, you know, is cool to see and also kind of funny, because you think, wow, I was so proud of that script, and now it's so much better, and none of it is my code, but hey, who cares? So it's really, really cool. It's a great little script now that Doug has gone in and patched it up. And he's done a lot of things where I would do things very repetitiously, essentially, you know, echoing this line and echoing that line and echoing that line into a document, because that's how I wanted it to be formatted or whatever. And there's a module for the sort of make it pretty, you know, a pretty print XML format thing. So there were a lot of things that he was able to add that just made the script a lot more efficient, which is nice. And then there are some things that he just implemented correctly, whereas I had implemented them incorrectly. So I'm posting the code. You will see the link in the show notes. The script is there. It exists now. It is an automatic Hydrogen drum kit generator. I call it Gen Hydro, and it works. It works really well. If you use it, the workflow essentially is grab a bunch of sounds, put them into a directory, and run this script. That's pretty much what you do. And you'll end up with a nice little foo.drum kit. And once you have that, of course, you just open up Hydrogen, go to the Instruments menu, click on Import Library, and click on the Local File tab up at the top, and then browse your file system, and it will import your sound library for you. The sound library itself will be visible in the lower right panel of Hydrogen where all of your instruments are kept. If you've used Hydrogen, you probably already know this, or if you've opened it twice, then you probably know the panel I'm talking about. Click on the sound library tab and there's all your different sound or your different drum kits. Again, I've just given you 99 in the latest multimedia sprint version 2, which I delivered to you on the 21st of December, but now you can make your own as well, which should be a very, very powerful thing. Let me tell you, freesound.org is a fantastic resource for this. It's really, really cool. I almost wish I had done more of the free... I didn't have the idea to go to Freesound and just look for percussion kits until a little bit towards the end of the process, and at that point I really just couldn't take the time to spend to do another 30 drum kits, so I didn't. But Freesound is a really great source. If you go to like the sample section of Freesound, I mean, that's not a button or a tab anywhere, but if you kind of hunt around and find and get yourself into the place where people are putting samples of different things, whether it's a drum kit that they've sampled or just random sounds that kind of go together logically, then just grab that. They're all free sampling licenses. Dump them into a folder, run this script, and you're done. Currently, the script is pretty much FLAC only. It kind of expects to see FLAC and wants to see FLAC, and I did that on purpose. I did it because having wave-based Hydrogen drum kits just sounded silly to me. It just doesn't make any sense. They're big. They're cumbersome. If you grab something from Freesound, or if you're sampling stuff yourself, and you get it in wave or even MP3, then just convert them to FLAC. It'll save space, but sound just as good. Okay, probably enough about Python for now, so how about Perl? No, I'm not kidding, actually. So there's this really great script written in Perl called Flex Backup. And backup is a great topic. I mean, it's one of those topics that you could talk about every other episode on your podcast, and no one could ever say that you were talking about it too much because they all know deep down they don't back up enough. So, yeah, what about backup? Well, of course, I'm kind of an rsync guy. I've always been an rsync guy ever since I started playing around in the terminal, discovered rsync, because that was one of the reasons, one of the many reasons that I was getting into Unix at all, because I was concerned about the safety and sanctity of my data, because all the backup solutions I had tried up to that point had been very, very proprietary, very obtuse, and very bad about long-term support. They would come, they would go, my backups would languish with really no way to access them. So that was getting really, really old. So rsync was very, very refreshing to me. Now later I started wondering about disk space and things like that, and whether doing rsync was really the most efficient way to manage the backups. But honestly, even knowing that there are ways to use tar and do incremental backups and things like that, rsync still kind of does the job for me. But I was looking into backup solutions for my job, and Vulcan Rider, a guy in IRC, had suggested Backup PC, and that turned out to not work for what I was doing because of the different OS. The OS that I no longer use, Deep Geek, take a drink, and so that didn't work out because there were problems with the way that the rsyncing had to happen, and the SSHing had to happen with root permissions and all these other things. So it just didn't quite work out for me. But in the process, I found a really nice little tool called Flex Backup. It is a Perl script, and the configuration for this little Perl script is a lot simpler than Backup PC. Now, I'm not saying that it's a complete replacement for Backup PC. If you've ever used Backup PC, and I have a little bit, although I don't use it on a daily basis because, as I said, it didn't work out. But it's really, really nice. And one of the big features of Backup PC is that it allows each user to manage their own backup stash, which is fantastic. I mean, think about having 30 or 50 computers that you're backing up, or even 10, and people are coming to you saying, oh, I misplaced this file, I accidentally erased this file, accidentally totally saved it over itself, I need to restore it, you know, all these different problems that can happen. Well, if they've got access to their own backup history through a little web admin interface, then they can do that themselves, or you can show them how to do it, and then hopefully they'll catch on eventually. So Backup PC is very, very nice. I highly recommend it. I even wrote a guest chapter on the subject in a book that sadly is not going to be published now. I thought it was my big break, and the book got canceled by the publisher. So, oh well. Anyway, on to Flex Backup. So, Flex Backup, really cool little application, and very, very easy to set up. So, if you go to the website of Flex Backup, which is flexbackup.sourceforge.net, you will find where you can download it. Now, don't get freaked out by the fact that the stable version was released on October 10th, 2003. Quite the contrary. This is exactly what I'm talking about. This is a technology that is going to be responsible for managing your data, and it's still around in 7 years, or seven, eight, nine or 10, or whatever, how many ever years it is since 2003, this is still around, and that's a big deal to me. And even better than that, or along those same lines, is that this all is based upon tried and true Unix technology that has been around a lot longer than that. So this is just the front end. And if this front end ever goes away for whatever reason, I don't know why it would, but if it did, we would still have tar and rsync and SSH, things like that, and we could still get our data. So to me, this is just a huge deal. I really, really am fond of that kind of backing up solution. It's really, really easy to use too, but first I guess we should set it up. So you would download Flex Backup from flexbackup.sourceforge.net. When I found this program, I was, I think, on an Ubuntu system or something, because I was, like I said, I was writing this chapter for a book that never got published, but guest writing a chapter. And so I was on Ubuntu, and I think they had it just as a apt-get install. I have not seen it on many other distributions. I could be, maybe I'm not getting the name right for their repositories. I don't know. So you may have to go to the site to download it. For Slackware, I have built a Slack build. It's a little bit ugly. It's not super ugly. It's not offensively ugly, the Slack build. I don't think it lives up to the slackbuild.org standard, so I have not submitted it there. I have posted it, however, at slackermedia.info/slackbuilds. So if you want to grab it from that site, you can and use it. Otherwise, you can just do a make and make install, and it will install itself, whether it puts your manuals in a sensible location, the man pages in a sensible location, and all that other good stuff, I don't know. Can't guarantee. But it seems pretty reliable in general. So it's literally like one Perl script, which you can drop into user bin, and it's two man pages, which you can opt to read or not. You know, it's not really that it's not science, rocket science. What we do have to do, and which is also not rocket science, is set up the configuration file after you've installed it. So if you open up the configuration file, that's /etc/flexbackup.conf, you'll see, we'll just go from the top. For the first option is $type, and that kind of gives you this your choice between what kind of archive type you want. The default is AFIO. I have no clue what that is. Never heard of it. Doesn't mean it's bad, I'm just saying, honestly, I've never heard of it. So I went with tar, because I know tar. I'm comfortable with tar. But, you know, you've got CPIO, STAR, PAX, ZIP, AR, other formats that you could go with if if you want to, but I changed that to tar myself. Next option is a set. Now a set, you can create sets, meaning, okay, I will back up this set. It's like a group, and you can give each set a specific name. You don't necessarily have to create sets. You can do a directory directly with the -dir command, so flex backup -dir space slash home slash clat2 would just grab my home folder and back that up to whatever location. Lately I've been trying to make use of sets because I'm trying to distribute my backups across different servers, just kind of like for added redundancy and kind of more off-site stuff. So I've been trying to get into sets, but honestly, I started out using the -dir and just, I manually told the cron job that I have this have running this thing to simply grab my home folder and copy it over. So however you want to do that, that's fine. Let's assume we're going to go with a set. So we'll say $ set curly brace single quote my code close single quote close curly brace equals quote slash home slash clat2 slash code close quote semicolon. So that would say grab my code folder from clat2 and back it up to some place, and we'll get to where that some place is in a minute. The next ones we can kind of skip over. You can kind of read them and figure out like compression level and stuff like that. Not really that important. Buffering program, I don't exactly know what that is. I didn't even bother looking it up. I do know that I set it to false. I haven't had a problem. I'm assuming that that's for a tape drive type setup where you are sending information to some device faster than it can be written to the device. So I skipped that. I just put false for that and left everything as is, and I've not had a problem at all. Now the next option you'll see is device. This is by default set to /dev/tape. So they are assuming in this configuration file that you have a tape drive that you're backing up to. I'm assuming the opposite. I'm assuming that you, like myself, do not have a tape drive and are not backing up to tape. So there are two options here, really, for you and me. You could do $device equals single quote slash, for instance, /media slash big drive slash backups, you know, and that would put all of your backups into some hard drive called big drive connected, mounted on your /media directory into a folder called backups. So that would just be a local drive, right? So you've got a drive, you've got it plugged into USB or whatever, you would send it to some folder, some pre-existing folder in that drive. That's kind of the normal, like, oh, I just want to make sure I have another copy of this data, and so that would do that for you. Now, you could also do very easily, because it's just programmed to use SSH, you can also do remote backups. So if you know how to SSH to a server, then you know how to set this up for remote backing up. And that's really, really nice. And it's a lot easier in this program, at least as I recall, than trying to do it with Backup PC. Although there's a bunch of things that Backup PC does that this one doesn't. But anyway, it's very simple. And all it is the same syntax as an SSH. So if I wanted to back up to some internal file storage server, I might do something like $device equals single quote clat2 at 192.168.4.50:\backups. And that would send it out to that server into my home folder on that server into the backups directory on that server. Now if it's a server out in the real world, then it would simply be a question of making sure that, again, that kind of makes that you've got the right IP address and that you're sending it to the correct location. So it would just be a non-internal IP address, like, you know, 108.68.54.32:\home/not clat2/backups. Whatever. So the point is, if you can SSH to some place, just enter the destination as your device, and it will send it there. More on that in a minute. So that's pretty much it, I think. think the remote shell is already set to SSH by default, so that's what you would probably want to use. And, oh, there's one more thing. It's called static files. You want to set that to true. It is set to false by default, again, for tape drive stuff. Tape drives aren't like hard drives where they can just search for parts of files across the platter and then come back to where it was. You know, it's not like that. It's linear. From what I understand, that's the reason that they set it to false here, because, again, they're assuming that you've got a completely linear tape drive, so they actually back up things redundantly on a tape drive, whereas you wouldn't have to do that with this. So we're passing the true argument to static files, or the true value, I guess, to static files. Okay, technically that's all we have to do, but there is one more flexibility kind of thing that we could look at really quick. If you keep scrolling down in the conf file, you'll see that by default, the log location for log files and temp files and the tape indexes and or the backup indexes and timestamps, things like that, those are set to /var/log/flex/backup, which makes sense, but it also requires root. So if you're going to try to do this without requiring root to run flex backup, then you might want to change those things to some place that you as the user can write to. So that's an option. Instead of putting your log files in /var/log, you could do it to, I don't know, /var/log or something like that. And then you as the normal user could execute flex backup and it wouldn't complain about not being root. But anyway, that's it. It's now configured, which, believe me, is so much easier than really any other backup solution, I mean, command line-based backup solution I have really found. I also like it because it is, like the name suggests, very flexible. You can have it require root, you can have it have different sets for backups, you can have different compression levels, you can tweak it as much as you want. And I like that because backing up can be very confusing, especially if you're trying to be diverse about it and kind of make sure that you've got all your data in places that if disaster strikes, it's not going to go down with the disaster. So you get confused as to what is going where or when it went there. So having it in like sets or being able to go and look at the conf file and say, oh yeah, okay, I get it. So on Wednesdays I back this up, and on Mondays I back that up, or, you know, whatever. I don't know. I like the very easy conf file of flex backup. So now we can run it, technically. Couple of things to be aware of. One is, of course, if you're doing a remote backup, SSH, then in order for this to run as expected, then you should have SSH access, rather access to the SSH server without being asked a password. Because if you are going to make this a cron job, obviously you wouldn't want a password prompt to be hanging you up because you are not going to be around all the time. And besides, honestly, I haven't even tried it, but I'm not even sure that you'd see the password prompt. I'm not really sure because, I mean, unless you were manually firing it off or something. But yeah, so you want the passwordless access turned on in your SSH thing. Obviously don't take your password off your server, just make sure that you've got your SSH key over on the SSH server so that you can log in and it's just a key handshake and no password is required. And besides that, honestly, it's generally considered more secure to do it that way, so why wouldn't you do it that way? If you don't know how to do that, look up either ssh-copy-id or look up, I'm sure there's probably an HPR episode on the subject, and I've probably talked about it myself, and if not, shame on all of us. But do that. So, and before you run Flex Backup, you'll want to do a test. You know, do an SSH to the server that you're going to go to, and see if you can log in without typing in a password. And if you can't, then make that work first, because otherwise Flex Backup is not going to work. The other thing that you want to make sure is that Flex Backup has the ability to run as root, or that you've made it possible for Flex Backup not to have to be root in order to run. So again, that goes back to that conf file where it was defining /var/log as the parent directory for its log files. Can't write to that unless you're root. So you could change that to something that root can write to, that non-root can write to, or you could use something like sudo, or sudo, however you say that, and give yourself permission to run Flex Backup without a password. Okay, so the way that you do that is with visudo. So you type in sudo visudo. That's sudo space visudo, all one string. And it brings up the configuration file, essentially, for sudo. You may have seen this before, or maybe you've at least heard it mentioned. But here you can add a line that says your username. So in this case, it would be klaatu, because klaatu is going to trigger Flex Backup. So klaatu space, all capital, all, A-L-L, space equals space no password. It's all caps too. I don't really know if the caps matter or not, but that's how it was, so I do it. No password is NOPASSWD, all one string, colon, space /usr/bin/flex backup. So you're saying, let klaatu, without a password, execute this exact location, which is /usr/bin/flex backup. And from then on, you'll be able to type in Flex Backup, and it will run, it will not ask you for a password, and it will run Flex Backup as root. Okay? So those are your two options. You might think there's another option, but I think the thing that you're thinking of is not secure, so I wouldn't do it. So there you go, Flex Backup. Now we need to make our, it's all configured now. It's ready to go. We've confirmed that we can execute the command, that we can get into the server that we need to get into if we're doing a remote backup, or that our hard drive is plugged in if we're doing a local backup. And now it's time for your first initial exciting backup. So you would do flex backup space -set space mycode space -level space 0. So that again was flex backup, that's the command, space -set, so now we're invoking, we're telling it which set to do, and we defined those sets, or that set, in the conf file, and I called my set my code, because I'm just backing up my code directory, and then space -level space 0, meaning this is the initial base layer of my backup. So that would do what we want it to do. Now, if you want to override that set, or if you don't want to use the sets, and this is what I used to do anyway, it would just be flex backup space -dir space /home/klaatu, for instance, space -level-0. So instead of giving it a set name with sort of a predefined location, you're giving it a directory manually, and that's fine. That works perfectly well. It should give you a bunch of feedback. It's very verbose. It tells you exactly either what's going wrong, for instance, I'm not root, I can't write to /var/log, or it tells you what went right. In other words, hey, look at all the things I'm backing up for you. So it'll take a while, obviously, because it's your very first backup. That's kind of to be expected. And from then on, you can run it with a variation on that command. And, or you could add this to your cron tab as well, and that would be flex backup space -set space my code space -level space incremental. The word incremental, I-N-C-R-E-M-E-N-T-A-L, incremental. And that will do exactly what it sounds like it will do. It will make incremental backups of that set, in this case my code, however I schedule it. So if I'm doing it in a cron tab, I might say, okay, do it every day at 5 a.m. or whatever. So it is really that easy. You're now being backed up, so the obvious final thing to figure out would be, okay, how do I restore my backup? Because now I've lost, maybe you've deleted a file on accident, because you aren't using my wonderful shell script Trashy. It's actually not so wonderful. I wouldn't blame you for not using it. You RM'd something that you weren't supposed to RM, or you just screwed it up beyond all recognition, and you're not using Git, so you need to restore something from a backup. Well, think about, I mean, just because it's on the command line doesn't mean it's any different than, you know, your flashiest, prettiest, lickable backup application on your GUI. So it's easy, right? In the GUI, you would sort of mentally identify, okay, I've lost this file, foo.txt. Now I need to get that back. So you would open up like your backup program and search through your backup directories, you know, like you'd find where that thing was, and you would find it based on where foo.txt used to be, right? So if foo.txt was in /docs or maybe /code, then that's where you would look in your backups. You would look there. Well, we don't have a flashy GUI here, but it's pretty simple to find it nevertheless. So you can do a zgrep or zgrep. So zgrep space foo, for instance, /media/clatu/backups /*.gz. So we're just grepping archives here located in my backup folder. And I'm grepping all of my archives. And this will search all of my archives. Incrementals, level zero, everything. And of course it'll return every instance that it finds within those sets. So let's just say, for instance, that we have, four results, right? Well, then we would want to grab probably the most recent of those. We wouldn't want to grab it from level zero. We would want to grab the one that was most recent, because that would presumably have all the changes that we have had since that first backup. I mean, it's always kind of a toss-up because, well, how much did you change it between the time that you backed up? You know about that. But the point is that you would want to grab that backup. So then to restore it, all you need to do is move to the directory from where the file comes. So if it's /code, we would go there, and we want to see foo.txt there. It's gone. It's missing. That's why we're backing. That's why we're restoring. So the command to restore is /extract the name of the archive. So in this case, it would be home-clatu.4.tar.gz /one file /foo.txt. And that would grab just one file from my archive, which is at level 4, and place it into my home directory in code. Now, of course, what we're not seeing it do is rippling back through all of the previous backups, like all those increments, and grabbing all the little bits and pieces that it needs to do to reassemble that file with all of the latest changes in it. Ergo, making life easier. Just in case, should you ever be unfortunate enough to need a full restore of like everything, like maybe your hard drive just died or something, then you can extract. What you would do is you would extract the zero level archive into your new hard drive. You know, just I would make my users. Now I've got an empty home clatu. I would then just untar the zeroth level into my new home, and after that, then I would restore all of the incremental backups after that. So I would just go through and untar again into my new home each incremental backup, and at the end of that process I would have a full restore of my base layer plus all changes that had happened before my hard drive died. And that's how you would do that. And I would imagine you would want to do that as like a for loop or something like that. You wouldn't want to sit there and manually do that, but again, kind of basic tar stuff at that point. So it's really nice. It's a really great kind of mildly hands-on, but not so hands-on that it just gets stupid and confusing. You know, I mean, yes, I like the fact that I can see all of my backups and that they've got increments and that they're all in little tar archives that I can access when I need them, and well into the future we'll be able to access them when I need them. And I also very much like that I don't actually have to figure all of that stuff out, like how to get everything back together. Flex Backup kind of manages that for me. So, really, really nice. You should check it out. I think you will like it. I certainly do. And now let's take a coffee break. I know, after last episode, you thought I was going to be drinking tea again, right? No, I told you it wasn't permanent. It was a one-time thing. This time I am drinking coffee again, and hopefully you are too, and hopefully you are having good coffee, because this is good coffee. Okay, final topic, or almost final topic for this episode. I got some feedback about a week ago, maybe, from someone who I'm actually not allowed to divulge the identity of, which sounds weird, and actually it is, but these are my listeners. These are you, my dear listener. This is how you guys are, and me too. So yes, some nameless person gave me some feedback about something, and anyway, from this email, it came about that on LXER, which is a news site, there was this story about podcasts, and that I was mentioned in this story, which I found overwhelmingly exciting, because I think I've seen like two other lists of podcasts. One was in a magazine, and I forget, I'm just assuming there must be another one, and I was not mentioned, so I kind of felt like lists of podcasts didn't mention GNU World Order, and I was okay with that. I am okay with that. But this one actually mentioned me, apparently, so I went to check it out, and sure enough, it was on this site called Make Tech Easier, which you've possibly heard of. Maybe you may have been there, maybe not. You might have referred someone else to it, because it is geared towards people who need to have tech made, well, easier for them. So anyway, I go to the site, and there's this story about podcasts for open source geeks or something like that, and sure enough, I was mentioned. GNU World Order was actually at the top of the list. I initially thought that that meant I was number one, like, you know, the best, but actually, apparently, it wasn't a list that was in any particular order, and that I was simply, I just happened to be at the top. Now, you can call that anything you want. I say I'm number one, so I'm still pretty proud of that. Anyway, I thought it might be nice to write the author and thank her for mentioning me, because, I don't know, I just thought it was kind of cool that some random tech writer out there was listening to my show, at least enough to mention my podcast on a list. So I emailed her, thanked her, and come to find out, she's this incredible artist doing really, really cool and very weird art online, and it's really, really great stuff. And so I got really excited about this, because not only is this person doing, well, tech writing, which is kind of something that's near and dear to my heart, because I do a lot of that myself. Used to do it as my job, a part-time job, and so I was kind of interested in that. But she's doing, like, you know, the whole Linux and art geek thing. And that's, it's not super rare, but it's kind of rare. And it's refreshing to see that kind of, I guess, diversity, for lack of a better word, coming into Linux. Because I know that at a time, not since I've used Linux, but I heard about it for some time, that Linux was, for a very long time, just, you know, really just the computer science people, just the sysadmins, and that was kind of the user base. And if you met someone doing art on Linux, it was kind of a unique thing. And now it feels like that is starting to really kind of broaden. So the author's name is Reggie, and you can actually hear her on, well, you can hear her a lot of places now, because she's on Hacker Public Radio, the New Year's episode, but she actually did another episode for HPR in the past. I don't remember when. It was called something like OS 10 Whoredom to Linux, or something funny like that. It was a very clever name. So she's on HPR, but she's also got her own podcast that she keeps insisting is in just alpha stage, which, you know, I mean, I remember those days. I remember alpha. And I'm like 8 seasons in now, so who knows what'll happen with that. But perhaps even more Like the greater body of work maybe is her webcomic, which I find utterly brilliant. It's a webcomic about a depressed guy, which admittedly doesn't sound like really a topic for a webcomic, and perhaps sometimes it's not, but it is really, really good, and it goes sort of back and forth between the very, very beautiful and the very, very dark, and a lot of times the very, very funny. Really, really rich work, actually. I actually bought a hard copy of that one because it's just really, it's got some really, really cool things in it. So check that out if you want to, if you're into webcomics. And she's got writing and screenshots of obscure operating system stuff on her website. You'll see. Just go to regic.net. That's RUJIC.net. And I'm going to have her on the show eventually to talk to her about her creative process. And this obviously kind of harkens back to the Lost in Bronx interview as well, and something that's kind of been really, really exciting as someone who comes from an artistic background and does a lot of art projects and doing this stuff on Linux. It's at the point now, I hope, where you almost kind of have to ask the question of whether which comes first. You know, does free computing come from free culture, or does free culture come from free computing? I'm inclined to think the former, I think, was what I said, that free computing comes from free culture, even though historically the formalization of free computing might have happened before the formalization of free culture. And by formalization, I kind of am just referring in my own mind to GPL versus Creative Commons. Which came first? I think it was the GPL. I could be wrong. You can fact check me. Point is, it doesn't really matter. I'm just saying, more like philosophically, how do these things play, at least in the mind of an artist? And for me, it's the free culture sort of comes first, because you, as an artist, even though you're putting your stuff out there, you kind of might want to step back and think, well, how can I make free art on a non-free computing platform? I mean, it's obviously possible. It's physically possible. It is totally possible, and it's something that I would even argue that, you know, I mean, if that's how an artist is going to express themselves, then hey, whatever it takes, right? I mean, the last thing you need when you're an artist to be worrying about is whether you're free enough in your computing platform. I mean, you should, but you also can't be bothered. You know, there's a certain point at which you have to sort of take your priorities, and are you going to do your art, or are you going to learn a new computing platform? And there's a place and a time for each of those two different things. But what I'm saying is that philosophically, can you make free culture on non-free computing? Because in order to do that, you kind of have to almost ignore that computing is an art. You know, it has to become something other than art, and I don't think that's correct. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, that free programming and programming in general is an art form. It's the expression of people, and expression is important. It's hugely important. Art is important for all of us, and not all of us can paint, so some of us program and stuff like that. So anyway. I'm going to have Reggie on the show at some point to talk about her creative process and the computing stuff that she does and how she does all of that. But you should also listen to her on her own podcast. It's really good. Reggie, I think it's podcast.reggiec.net or something like that. Just go to her site, you'll find it. And yeah, it's really cool stuff. I want to also talk about another sort of artist friend of mine, Sig Flup. You probably know Sig Flup from Hacker Public Radio, certainly, and Sig Flup has also helped a lot on the UnixPorn.com site, and for a while there, I had updated UnixPorn, the back end that was running it. I updated it, and I accidentally sort of updated us right out of compatibility with Sig Flup's very, very cool line command application called Yes Please. That's YESPLZ, and that kind of broke Yes Please for a while. And then out of the blue, over New Year's Eve, Sig Flup looked at the code and fixed it and made it compatible again. So if you've been missing Yes Please, which is, if you haven't missed it because you don't know what it is, it's just a line command application that you can use, much like Scrot, if you've ever used Scrot to take screenshots. So you can just issue Yes Please and a couple of arguments, and it will take a screenshot of your screen and upload it to your account at Unix Porn. And if you don't have an account at Unix Porn, it's free. You can use fake information, doesn't matter. You can sign up, and then you can post screenshots. Another sort of side benefit of Yes Please is that it is written in C. Like, it's not a script or anything like that. It's an actual application that needs to get compiled, and that means that one of the side benefits of it, more or less, is that you can use it as a really useful example, I have found, of packaging. Like, if you're trying to learn packaging, Yes Please is great for that, and I will tell you why. And I did actually 3 episodes on packaging using Yes Please as the target, or the subject of the package. And it's great, because it's really small and simple, but it's really, really useful. So it feels a lot better than packaging something like, you know, what is it, GNU Hello, or Hello World, or whatever it is. I mean, there's a demo application out there. I think it might be GNU Hello. And it's really easy. It's just something that you can practice, I guess, packaging and stuff like that on. It's there. It's small, but it's also useless. It's utterly useless. Yes Please is useful. You can actually do stuff with it. It's a fun little application. It's got ASCII art, and it's just a fun application. So you can take it and package it up as a Slack build pretty darn easily, a BSD port really easily, an RPM really easily, and probably a .deb, and surely an AUR, because Cobra 2 actually packaged it up as an AUR for Arch. So, as of right now, we have about 4 different package formats we have it packaged into 4 package formats, so you can certainly get Yes Please as an Arch AUR, whatever that means. I don't actually know if I'm saying these right, but Arch AUR, and don't correct me, I know you use Arch, I don't want to hear about it. Arch AUR, Slack build, BSD port, and RPM. Actually, I only have the RPM spec file posted right now. I haven't gotten around to doing an RPM build environment on a Fedora box, but I will get that done and get that posted. It's all on unixporn.com. Go to the front page, and there's links to the packages, except the AUR one. That's not up there yet, but you can probably find that however Arch people find AURs. Very easy. Yes Please. YESPLZ. Now I'm going to debate internally for a moment whether to tell you the truth or not, you know, that I paid Reggie off for mentioning my show on her list, but no, I think I'll keep that to myself. Okay, that's it for this episode, I think. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
active families need.
Univac, the giant electronic brain.